Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rockbury. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome our producer extraordinaire, Paula Flack. Paula, how are you? How are things?
I'm good, thanks, Colin. How was your trip to San Francisco?
It was epic. It was absolutely an incredible weekend or 6 days. Yeah, we had a great time.
Wow. Did you cycle over the Golden Gate Bridge?
I did not cycle over the Golden Gate Bridge, but I did get to drive along the coast in a 1957 Corvette.
I saw pictures of that. Amazing.
That's very amazing.
Wow.
It was a proper red, that old almost orange red color with the with cream scoop on the side.
You should have just drove it home.
I felt very much
you
like
just drove straight home.
I should have
just
living the dream.
I'd like to buy one, Jason. I would.
You need one in Ireland.
If only I knew somebody who could get their hands on one.
You know, I had one. I had a 56 Vet, black with white scoops. Ugh, I almost killed myself a million times.
It was incredible.
If you take a car, an American like car to Ireland, you have to re-outfit it?
No. You can, I've seen
No.
Right-handed steering in Ireland. Yeah, it's you wouldn't have to.
It's actually they're worth a fortune over here because you can't. Yeah, they're worth a fortune because you can't get them here. They were never.
Wow.
They were never released over here, so.
Well, with all the money you're going to make from the Sync Report, Colin, you can buy one.
maybe Jason could get me one as a gift. How about that?
Yes, that's okay.
Hey, I already had it on my list. One for each of us.
He can get it. It'll match the Rolex that he's getting made for me then as well.
Yeah.
Who's telling you all the secrets? Oh, no. Now I got to return it. It's not a surprise anymore. Sorry, Colin.
Is this the metaverse or the real version?
Yeah. The metaverse. Well, on that note, Paula, who have we got in the show this week?
Yeah, we have Josh Nicotra on the show this week, Colin. Josh began his career at Universal Records as director of new media and director of marketing. He went on to work at Universal Republic Records, and then, since 2005, Josh has been the general manager at Brushfire Records in Los Angeles. Co-owned by Jack Johnson and Emmett Malloy, Brushfire Records has released albums by Jack Johnson, G Love and Special Sauce, Bahamas, Rogue Wave, Matt Costa, Neil Halstead, who was part of Mojave 3, Mason Jennings, Z Avi, ALO, Zach Gill, and Money Mark.
Amazing.
In 2013, Josh set up his own management company with Lucky Man Management, attracting artists such as ALO, Oregon band Fruition, Jacob Anderson, Mimi Naha, instrumental prog band Talk, Americana band TK and the Holy Know Nothings, and Zach Gill, artists that can also sometimes be worked into Brushfire's roster. Please welcome Josh Nicotra to the show.
Yay! Thanks, everybody. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you. Yeah, looking forward to it.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you here and learn about you and your musical journey. Your name unquestionably is sealed in the annals of music and for the creation of one of the great music archives and record labels. But you're neither the first nor the second generation label executive in your family. In fact, I'm blown away to learn that it was your mother and your grandmother who worked at labels. Is that right?
Yes, it was kind of a mix of labels, production companies, publishing companies, except, you know, studios, but they were in the business, you know, well before I was born. My grandmother, you know, was at Nevins Kirshner, Al Nevins and Don Kirshner, Aldon Records. Back in, you know, I'm actually unsure what year she started there, but I know that my mom did a summer job there in 61. And then I think she was there 62 and then eventually went to work for Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller at Lieber Stoller. Wow. Worked for them when they started up Redbird Records and Blue Cat Records onto, like, you know, a pretty big assortment of studios and producers and publishing companies for a little bit there. And then by 1969, she was working for Seymour Stein at Sire. Wow. And then some of their publishing efforts at the time, which is around when she met my father, who was also peripherally in the music business. He was managing an artist named Peter Kelly, who was also, I guess, a notorious marijuana dealer. And he had a record he had made called Dealer's Blues. And I guess my mom was at Sire when he came in trying to shop that record. That's kind of how they met. So I guess I would not even exist without the music business.
Wow.
Yeah. Her last job in the music business was at Arista Records from 75-ish to around 82 as initially like a manager of A&R admin and then a director and then eventually I think the first female vice president at Arista.
I hope you realize, you know, what this man is sharing with us. I mean, the walls that his grandmother and mother broke down in this industry, I mean, completely iconic. I mean, just absolutely incredible.
The bad old days. Yeah. I mean, you know, your grandmother worked on the record label for Locomotion. I have a framed 45 of Locomotion. Famous, yeah, from that period. But
I didn't even know that.
Between me and my sisters, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, that's one of those times where I think, you know, kind of think about like when's the first time you kind of like had an inkling that, you know, your family had kind of been around some cool moments. I mean, you know, everybody likes to tell stories, but one of my grandmother's stories was that they were trying to figure out, you know, what the dance should be for the Locomotion before she was going to go on TV. And that my grandmother was quite a dancer and, you know, led line dances at, you know, Brighton Beach Baths up until her, you know, 70s. But she claims to have kind of come up with the dance that ended up being used on TV for the Locomotion.
Wait, so Josh, so when they wrote that song, there wasn't a, like, let's do the Locomotion. They're singing about doing a song and there wasn't a
dance. They did this song before the dance.
Unbelievable. Oh my God. That is the coolest thing I've ever heard.
That's incredible. Yeah. Because we all did the Locomotion. We all, I was crazy. How old were you, Josh, when your mom was working at Arista?
So I was born in 74. She went back to work in, I guess, mid 75, probably when I was around a year and a half, you know, just a baby up until, you know, really until I was about 8 years old when she left. And really, she had been remarried when I was about five and moved to Connecticut. And I think in the end, it was being on Metro North, you know, three plus hours every day round trip, it just kind of became untenable. And that's why she
and
left
in
the
those
business.
Days, there were no remote options.
No, and not a lot of forgiveness if you were prioritizing family either.
That's for
this
sure.
This is a business built on being out late nights. And, you know, if you're leaving to take the train back to New Haven every day,
that's a lot.
It's definitely not going to help.
And do you have any specific memories of some of the artists that she was working with at the time?
You know, the one that I most vividly remember is probably Lou Reed. You know, I was maybe around five or six at that point. So I just remember, you know, he didn't like going into the building. So when he went, he would go to my mom's office and kind of like wait in there rather than in a lobby.
Right.
And so I guess I met him twice. I only remember once.
Yeah. But,
you know, he did end up being one of my favorite artists. So kind of cool that he's somebody I came across. But she was an A&R admin, so basically kind of had the keys to the purse strings of, you know, album budgets and, you know, can we afford to extend an additional advance? So I know she was fairly popular with the artists that she was working with.
And in those days, the artist contracts were very weird. I mean, there were things in those contracts that today you could never admit to, but there was a lot of weird stuff going on with those artists in those days from the labels. They were just all trying to make them happy in every single way possible. Were you aware that your mom had a really cool job when you were a kid?
Yes, but not, you know, it's not like I was going to, you know, these days I see some of my contemporaries, you know, like I'll meet their kids at festivals and stuff like that. You know, that wasn't really much of a thing back then. And you certainly weren't bringing like a six-year-old to a nightclub to see a show or even, you know, an arena at that point. Times have changed. But I definitely knew, you know, like music was always kind of keystone for me, you know, before I can even have a memory. It's like always the thing that would kind of stop me in my tracks. So I know, you know, she would be, you know, playing me stuff that, you know, she was working on. And I did know that like she was working on something that really struck a chord with me.
Well, we have a clip of Leave Me Alone by Lou Reed that was recorded for Arista in 1979. You want to play that, Vilfredo? Everybody gonna try to tell you what to do. And never, 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 never let it be said that it's true.
Yeah, amazing. So I want to move on a little bit, Josh, if that's okay. And I sort of want to find out, what kind of music were you listening to when you were a teenager? You know, what were you passionate about?
You know, it's funny now, as I listen back to the, you know, the stuff in the early 80s that at the time I couldn't stand and now kind of see quite the merit in it. But at that time, I was very much, you know, like the music of the 60s and 70s was everything for me, you know. Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, The Who, you know, Dylan, those were kind of like Pink Floyd. All of those were the things that I would kind of listen to on loop. Obviously back then, you had radio and you had the few records you could afford, you know, and so the ones that you did own, you would listen to a ton. Those are some of the biggest early records for me that, you know, still stick with me to the day.
Do you remember what your first record was?
Well, let's see. I think my first vinyl record was a Hendrix record. I got probably Are You Experienced and Electric Ladyland all around the same time, but I think it was Are You Experienced that I got first. And then I do remember when CD came around, I got like a little boom box with a CD player and I think went to Cutler's Records in New Haven and pulled... Back when they were doing long boxes, so they would fit in the old vinyl bins. Robert Plant's "Now and Zen" when it was a brand new release. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I told you this guy has great taste.
And what was your first concert?
The first concert I went to of my own volition was Pink Floyd at Giant Stadium on the Momentary Lapse of Reason tour. Yeah. Which, you know, I mean, if that's your first show, of course you're going to end up working music in the live music business. It's like,
I was just going to say, that's got to be one of the best first shows that anybody's
and was that with Roger Waters?
It's pretty much out there.
And was that with Roger and Dave Gilmour? They were both
No, Roger was out at that point. I was too young to know the difference. You know, I kind of hadn't keyed in on the
and it
the
didn't matter
at that
really
point.
Those shows were
I mean, it was incredible. You know, I just vividly remember the commercial coming on the radio, like, hey, join the WPLR Rock Fest down to Meadowlands. And, you know, like I turned to my mom, I was like, please. And she's like, no way. You know, like, you're 13, forget about it. And then I wouldn't leave her alone, like, for like, I think it was like a week. And then she was like, all right, stop it. Like, I had already bought you the ticket. I just can't listen to you, like, ask about this anymore. So
did you go
like,
on your own? Or
Well, she didn't buy two tickets.
Were you on your own?
She bought one. And she took me down to like the New Haven High Line, where I got on a bus with probably, I don't know, 40 other people, all of who were, I'm sure, 20, 30, 40, not 13. And I remember there was just like, you know, tons of cases of beer like being brought on. And one dude had like a cowboy hat with like joints like in the hat band. And, I mean, you know, I had no idea what I was in for, but it was certainly formative. And I still can't believe my mom let me get on that bus and come back by myself. It was kind of mind blowing.
It was kind of like an Almost Famous moment, huh?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It was wild. And yeah, to that point, you like kids these days would never have been allowed to do something like that.
I don't know.
No, well, I think I'm not sure kids these days get to go to like I went to my first concert when I was 7. No, I went with my dad and my brother. But
wasn't
it was
that
like,
Michael Jackson?
It was Michael Jackson, the Bad tour in Dublin, and that was it was a proper concert. Do you know what I mean? But my son's 8, nearly 9. But I couldn't imagine taking him to a stadium concert at the minute.
Go see the Gorillaz.
And I'd love to, but. But you know what I mean? Like I don't know. It's just a different sort of. I mean, I'd love to, but it's just a different type of.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine sending a 13-year-old.
It's a different time now, Colin. Look, in the 70s in America, my mom wouldn't let me in the house until the street lights came on. I'd be riding my bike off who knows where. Yeah. It was a much safer, different.
Go to the park, come back for dinner.
Yeah.
Back for dinner.
Well, I had tickets last week for a Thurston Moore concert and I got enough for my son to go. He's 12 and he was not interested at all in going. Wow. No. So Andy,
who the hell's Thurston Moore?
Sonic Youth.
Oh, shit. All right. Well, that's cool.
Cut that one out.
I will be editing that out.
That'll
be edited out.
No, you know, I like to. I'm the fool on the stage. It's all right.
Well, okay, on that note, we've got a clip of Led Zeppelin, Hots for Nowhere.
So, Josh, we already established that your mom let you go on a bus to Giant Stadium from New Haven. Did your parents encourage you to go into the music business?
No, actually, my mom knew how much I love music, but also, you know, as you alluded to earlier, knew, you know, the vibe of the business. And she thought I was too nice to get into the music business. you know, she was just like, you know, a lot of the folks that have, you know, been successful in the version of the business that she knew were a little more cutthroat than she had seen me be as I'd gotten older. So she, you know, was like, just let this be a beautiful hobby. You know, don't make it your career. You know, don't try and do that. It's kind of a brutal business.
Yeah, but in those days when your mom was in that business, there were a lot of thuggy people at the
Alan
top.
Klein.
Yeah, I mean, it was, it really was a lot of street guys, if that's the best way I can say it, got involved in that business at that time. And they weren't nice guys. They just weren't, you know, so I can understand that.
Yeah, totally. And you know, I think the nice thing is that for me, it wasn't a pipeline to a job. You know, she had left, obviously, when I was quite young. So by the time I was looking for job, only a few people that she had worked with at the time were still in the business, and I didn't get into the business through that. I got into it through monster.com, but I know why I'm there, but I also know that I didn't get there because my mom put me in a job. So that's
right.
Nice part of her not encouraging me to get into the business.
But like, did you ever play an instrument or think about being an artist?
Well, I'll say this is like, I think I've got good ears. Early on, I could kind of hear as I was ham-fisting my way through trying to like learn guitar that there were people even just immediately near me, cousins, what have you, that like, it was just a much easier lift for them to start to learn how to play guitar. And I could hear early that I didn't have a great singing voice. So, you know, I never had a William Hung moment, but I just knew like, you know, I love this stuff, but I'm not kind of naturally gifted in creating it myself. So I never had any real illusions of making a performing move with it. It was always very much supportive. And I guess, you know, knowing that my mom had worked in a behind the scenes job, I knew that was a way that you could go.
And then there was Monster.com.
So was it always?
Yeah, you just had to put in the keyword music and look for everything that came up and start sending out resumes.
So was it always your intention then to work in the music business?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were to ask me early, you know, like, what do you want to do? Like, I would probably have said, I want to work in music, not, you know, I want to be a firefighter. Or, you know, maybe there was a time where I would have told you I wanted to be a baseball player, but and that would have been cool. But even now, you know, like, sports is probably definitely my second passion, but music is kind of never faded mm-hmm. from first place. So I was, like I said earlier, you know, a little bit of a realist, you know, so my plan was, after I graduated college, I was going to go and live in California. I'd been living with my dad for a couple of summers in Monterey Bay Area. And I was like, you know, I'm just going to go there for a year, become a California resident, and then go to either get a law degree or an MBA with an entertainment focus. And then if it doesn't work out, I've got a great degree that I could pivot on. And if it does, you know, great. But that never ended up happening. I got sidetracked at a graduation party. My stepfather's brother had a company he was starting, kind of like lured me in with like, hey, you know, you're broke. I could pay you for 3 months while I'm getting this company started, and then you could go to California. That turned into like a year, 2 years, you know, with like company car. I was making good money. Mm-hmm. And then I just had a realization. I was like, hey, like, I don't care about the car or the nice apartment. I wanted to be in music and I don't want to wait. So I told him, as much as I appreciated working with him and for him, that I had to kind of start pursuing like the career that I wanted. And that's when I kind of sent, I don't know, probably 50 resumes to anything that had music in the keywords. Mm-hmm. And one of,
I was going to say, did you have a mentor who sort of guided you along the way, or was it all just, did you sort of go it alone mostly?
Well, you know, I would say my first hire was certainly pivotal. Aaron Yasger was a former kind of product manager at Republic and had been tasked with creating the new media department. And she and a tech guy named Jan Otfen started that department, and they needed to kind of staff up. And she saw my resume and saw that like I was, you know, in Hamden, and her family had Hamden roots. And she, you know, brought me in for an interview and kind of gave me the first opportunity. So that was, you know, pretty important. And then Kim Garner was the SVP of marketing there. And at one point, a job came up there. And though she had kind of been looking outside of the company or maybe for somebody who had marketing department experience, she gave me an opportunity to kind of move over from new media and learn on the job. That was definitely the springboard for me working with Jack Johnson and Emmett Malloy on some of the early Brushfire releases that were imprint rather than distributed label releases. And when they went to create a distributed label through Republic and UMG, you know, they asked me to come out and help them run it. So both Aaron and Kim were kind of very instrumental in getting me to where I am today.
And so what was the most valuable piece of advice you received, or even lesson that you learned in the business?
You know, I can't point to like one specific piece of advice, I would say, but I will say that I think the lesson that I learned is that, you know, build your reputation one relationship at a time, and your reputation is important, and it stays with you, you know, for your career, both to the good and the bad. And, you know, to kind of always do the job that you would want to do, that you'd want somebody to do for you, you know? So I think my wife would kind of say it's to my detriment, but I always, you know, and I'm always available, I'm always thinking about what I can do for both my, you know, clients on the management side and the artists on my label. You know, I don't think of these things as records. I think of them as these people's lives, and I'm responsible for, in part, how that goes. So I've always kind of taken it very seriously. It's not just a job to me, and it's not just, you know, a record and there'll be another one coming. It's, you know, a piece of someone's life that I have to help shepherd.
So cool. What a conversation. Josh, thank you for your time today. This is just, I'm loving this. But I'm going to spin the conversation a little bit and kind of tilt us towards syncs and music placement into film. And specifically talking about your relationship, the responsibility that it comes with representing Jack Johnson's catalog, which I think I have every one of his albums. I absolutely adore this man and his work. It's so positive. It's so uplifting. But I think anyone who's a Jack Johnson's fan also knows his commitment to charity, to the environment. You know, he really has some very strong concerns, especially when it comes to, you know, his fan base and, you know, the integrity of his music. So I have a couple questions when it comes to music placement in film and TV, because we don't see or hear a lot of Jack Johnson's music within films. And I'm just wondering, is that, you know, and I probably could answer this question myself, but is that because, you know, the money's not right, the project's not right, the art isn't right? What, you know, what has prevented Jack Johnson from being more visible in soundtracks and syncs?
Well, I think there's probably a layered answer to that question. I mean, initially, Jack had a lot of, you know, unexpected success. I mean, and the funny thing is, like, he went to UCSB to become a filmmaker. He was making surf films, you know, to begin with. And he would be playing these songs while they were out filming stuff on surf trips. And people were always kind of being like, dude, that's a great song. You know, like, and so eventually, like, you know, some tapes of some of those songs started circulating in the surf community. Some of those songs ended up in surf films. And that was the beginning of the buzz on him. And, you know, if you kind of track through his career, you know, the initial success was immediate. The first record that he did with J.P. Plunier at Enjoy Records, which is now called Everloving Records, they had to have a name change. Huge hit right out of the box. You know, like that record was came out at the perfect time. There were a number of kind of singer-songwriter projects that really took off, and Jack's really captured this kind of feeling of the outdoors, of California, of Hawaii, totally. Where he has roots in both states, and never looked back, really. So it is funny in that, like, actually film and his music were very intimately intertwined at the beginning. And I think it made him even more precious about, you know, where you would want to use that music elsewhere.
Do you think that that sensitivity maybe has been distorted within the entertainment industry, where they just think, well, it's Jack Johnson, mega star, multi-platinum, and we just can't afford the music, and they might not understand that he's actually more committed to the art than the monetary benefits?
Yes, I think that probably is an accurate read. You know, for him, use and the way the music works with a scene is very important. You know, oftentimes when we get requests, we'll ask for a scene, which isn't always easy. You know, obviously, like, I know how it is. It's like projects are oftentimes on a very tight schedule. You know, you may not have time to kind of lay a piece of music in, send the scene, get it approved. Like, you may just say, hey, here's the description. Are you cool with it? Yeah. And just a description is usually not sufficient for Jack. He usually wants to see, you know, the scene it's being used in, if at all possible. But I think the no for him really was more tied to commercial syncs than film syncs. And we said no to so many commercial syncs that I think that is probably where the misperception comes from. And that people would be like, oh, he says no to everything because he was saying no to $1 million for Better Together to be in an insurance commercial. And, you know,
so what luck, in a hotel what commercial. Do we have?
Right. And so it's like, oh, he just says no, which really I think is totally a misperception. He is open to, he's open to TV. He's just very much not open to taking songs that, you know, people walk down the aisle to or proposed to their wife to or had playing in the delivery room when their child was born and try and sell a product with it. You know, the only time we've ever let a piece of his music be used in a commercial was in an iPod commercial, because it was like, hey, people are going to use this iPod to listen to the music. It makes sense. You know, that was it. That's the only time I've ever seen him say yes.
We had Jack Johnson on for when my daughter was born. He was one of the songs that we had on in the iPad.
So obviously Jack is saying yes to some things, because he ended up doing the entire soundtrack for Curious George. And this was in 2006. How did this happen? How did that project come to you? And was it always intended to be the entire soundtrack?
So that project was in the works when I left Republic to come here to work for Brushfire. So those gears were already turning, and I wasn't here for the very, very beginning of it. But my understanding was that they had a composer working on music for the film, and they wanted Jack to do a song for the film. And so Jack got together with the composer. They worked on a piece of music. I think the first one was Upside Down. And when they came out of the studio with that, it was kind of like, oh, wow, this is perfect for the film. And then it became like, well, how about like, you know, two or three others? And, you know, again, there are two or three songs off of that record that both Jack and the film company would have to approve on the publishing side, because they were collaborations with the composer that was working on it at the time. And then he ended up writing the rest of the record once those first three were done, and it was like, okay, well, you should do the whole thing. And then he ended up writing the rest of the record and bringing in some friends like G Love, his drummer Adam Topol, you know, a cover of We're Gonna Be Friends from Jack White, and rounded out that record, and it became a massive success for him. The film was a success, but I think the soundtrack was a way bigger success than the film was.
Definitely. You know what, Josh, I think we got to play Upside Down. Bill Fredo, can you spin this track from Curious George, please?
Who's to say what's impossible? Will they forget? This world keeps spinning, and with each new day I can feel a change in everything. And as the surface breaks, reflections fade, but in some ways they remain the same.
And I didn't even know this was part of the Curious George soundtrack. It was just, you know, the album was just something I loved, and that song was just gorgeous. So I think you're right. I think the soundtrack outsurpassed that film, and kudos to you guys for putting together such amazing music for that film.
Thank you. Yeah, it was great.
I saw the film, and definitely that music was absolutely perfect for the film. And, you know, I saw it with my daughter. She loved it. And, you know, it's really great to hear that take on how Jack Johnson looks at these opportunities. I mean, you know, that's really great to kind of get that background on it. So, but I know that every artist has their own opinion on using sync, not just to monetize their music, but to have their music found. How difficult is it achieving your collective artist goals while serving the needs of your business?
Well, you know, I think Brushfire as a whole was kind of founded to be a place for, you know, both Jack and his friends to release music. And it's always been a very kind of artist-friendly ethos. You know, we were doing 50-50 joint venture deals from the very beginning, which at the time, you know, everybody was kind of like, well, you're crazy. Why are you doing this? But Jack himself had been able to negotiate a great distribution deal, one of the kind of like the best early versions of having a label serve as your distributor and marketing arm, not the owner of your catalog. So when we started bringing other artists in, the thought was to extend that same kind of benefit to all of them. And we've always kind of looked at it like, you know, everybody's music is their own decision. You know, if you have a strong feeling about what music you want to go on there, and we disagree with, you know, hey, this song should be on the record, not that one, but you're adamant, then it's your record, you know, you win. If you want to license music to commercials, even though Jack doesn't personally, go ahead. You know, it's like, it really is a personal decision of where you feel comfortable seeing your music. And we all know at one point back in the day, like, if somebody put a song in a commercial, people would be like, oh, sellout move. Now it's like, congratulations, you know?
Yeah.
Because it has become harder to, you know, you used to be able to sell 10,000 CDs and, you know, have net billing of $90,000. Now you need, you know, 20 million streams on Spotify to get that. It's just different math. So exposure is more important than ever. Certainly the financial implications of syncs when they come from commercials can be quite significant. When they come from film companies and it's for a trailer that's going to be seen multiple times, it can be great. And then really, you know, if you marry the perfect song to the perfect scene in a TV show or a film, it can really be an incendiary moment for your career. So we never forbid anybody from doing anything. It's very much, you know, how do you feel about this? By the same token, we're not going to try and give you a hard sell if you don't want your song in a commercial or if you don't like the particular director or what have you, whatever the reason, it really is like what the artist wants. And so on our label, you know, somebody like Bahamas is very much like, I wrote these songs, I believe in them, I want people to hear them. So if they hear them on TV, great. If they hear them behind a scene of a film, awesome. The only thing they don't like is significant editing on the master. You know, like if the master works, great. If you have to chop the master and reorganize the musicality of the segment to make it fit a scene, that's usually where like they will draw a line. But they're a very easy yes for a lot of uses because they want people to hear it. But they want people to hear what they made, not a reconfiguration of what they made. So everybody's different. Neil Halstead's had a ton of film and TV uses for his music. And both of those, you can kind of track very significantly, like, hey, this song was in this film. It came out on this date and we saw a huge boost in streaming, or we sold more CDs depending on how long ago the use was. Bahamas had a song called All the Time in a Verizon ad that ran for 4 weeks. It went from, you know, 5,000 streams to like 100,000 streams in the course of a couple of days. And we sold a ton of iTunes downloads and radio started popping off. We've got to alternative instead of just AAA. I mean, kind of everything kind of sparked from it. So it's very clear that if you have the right piece of music in the right piece of content, whether that's a commercial or a TV show or a film, like it can be career changing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like you're more artist centric. And so that's really, really incredible, you know, to have that balance and that mix. And, you know, I'm a huge Bahamas fan. And so, you know, it's really great to hear the artists that are on your rosters. So I think that we're going to take a little time to hear one of my favorite bands, Bahamas. Mofredo, can you play All the Time?
Love that track. Oh, so freaking cool.
He's unbelievable. I mean, every record he's put out has been phenomenal.
Oh, like I said, you have the best taste. What a gig you have. I mean, you are just completely surrounded by like the greatest of the greats. Unbelievable, Josh.
I definitely feel very lucky. You know, obviously we talk about why, it's part of why I named my management company that, but you know, to be able to do what I do and work with the artists I do, it's been, you know, a real blessing, I find. And, you know, it's not an easy job. It's also not an easy job to get. There's only so many jobs in the music business. But I feel particularly fortunate, especially through my late career, to only really end up working on records that I really love and believe in. You know, no disrespect to certain records I might have worked on at Republic, but, you know, there were a couple of novelty songs where I was like, I can't believe I'm at the office, you know, at 10:30 on a Tuesday, like working on what's effectively, you know, like a one hit wonder and not a career artist. It's just kind of funny, successful because it's funny. Now, you know, by the same token, I got introduced to working with Brushfire and Jack. So it's like Republic's always been great about kind of both sides of the business, like signing like career artists and some things that are going to make, you know, a lot of money really quickly and then go away. So their research kind of based approach has always been, I think, impressive. But personally, for me, working on stuff that like I want to listen to in my free time is important. You know, if I'm going to dedicate as much of my life and energy to my job, it's got to be for music that I love and believe in. And that's been easy working at Brushfire.
So, Josh, you wear two hats, obviously, as a successful record label, and you are an artist manager. Do you actively go out and find new artists, or do you find people come to you? How does that work, working on both ends of the business this way?
When I first left Republic to come work for Brushfire, we were going to put out probably, you know, 5 to 7 records a year was kind of the goal. Over time, you know, Jack only kind of gets ramped up on an album and tour cycle probably every 3 years or so based on Hawaii. So his, initially, we had a large group of, like, folks he'd been touring with and people that we wanted to put out records with. Because he wasn't kind of like doing Road Warrior stuff and doing tons of festivals every year, it was more like every 3 years. The pool of like, who are my friends that I want to put out records from wasn't growing at the rate where you would just kind of find another friend to put a record out with. So we started doing more like 2 to 3 records a year, you know, 3 or 4. And so for me, who had come from like, okay, as a product manager, I've got 20 plus records that I've got to pay attention to when I was in New York at Republic, to now, you know, maybe 3 or 4. I kind of felt like, I guess I still had enough of my New York kind of manic energy. California hadn't mellowed me out enough at the time. I was just like, you know, there are things that I'm hearing that like, okay, you know, Jack and Emmett don't know them personally. I don't know them personally yet. I just like the music. I went and had a discussion with them of like, listen, if we are going to stay focused on, you know, friends and immediate, like kind of like one relationship away signings, I'm going to come across some stuff that I hear that I think I should be involved with their career. And I want to be able to do that. And because we were putting out slightly fewer records than what I'd kind of agreed to when I first came out, they kind of gave me the freedom to be like, hey, if you find something that you want to work on, you know, you have our blessing. Obviously, if you're managing a band and talking to promoters or talking to radio station, all those things are continuing to build your relationship base, which is going to help when you're working on a Brushfire record. If you wanted to go open a bakery and do something completely different, that doesn't help us and it would just be a distraction. But all of this is just building, you know, your network of people you know that you can pick up the phone and call or email or take a meeting with and, you know, go for it. So they were kind of very generous about that. I basically, my first signing was about a year and a half after I met them. But like I was at South by Southwest for Brushfire. We had a couple of artists playing that year. Bahamas was one of them. ALO was another. And I was walking down the street behind a large group of people, I think going from like La Zona Rosa, like walking all the way across town to Stubbs. And I just kind of took a quick left to go up Congress because the people in front of me were slow. And I just happened to walk by Fruition. They were busking on the street, didn't have any showcases. They just there trying to play so that somebody might hear them. And I almost just walked by them. But I heard a mandolin line into a 3-part harmony. And I just kind of stopped. And I was like, why are these people on the street? It was just too good. And so I dropped my card. I still had to get to my next showcase. I was like, hey, you know, I don't think you guys should be on the street. Do you have a manager? Yes. Like, okay, like have them give me a call. And so, you know, a couple of days later, I got a call from their friend and manager. And she said, hey, like, we've been trying to get something going. Nat Key from Hot Buttered Rum made our last record with us. We're just trying to make a dent, you know, like, would you ever be willing to just kind of give us some advice? And at that time, I wasn't entertaining doing stuff outside of Brushfire. So I just kind of gave them free advice for a year, really. And it got to the point where they're like, hey, we can't call you for more free advice. Would you ever, you know, work with us in a more official role? And that was right when I was having the conversation with Brushfire about, you know, doing some things outside. And that became my first management client.
We have a clip, Fruition. I can't stop. Alfredo, can you play that?
I try and do the best I can, try and be a better man. Sometimes I don't care.
But I still can read the signs and put the wheels between the lines when it's my time. But I can't stop, so I just go forever, yes.
So much great freaking music. Unbelievable.
Yeah. So you have a lot of different artists. Josh, you want to give us some broad strokes on some of the other great artists that you've got on your roster?
Sure, yeah. I think to your original question, you know, I am pretty selective about adding to my roster. I always want to make sure that everybody feels like they can get my full attention, even though that's not 100% possible. But I always want to feel like I have enough time to give everybody their fair due. So I have been selective about adding to my roster. And some of my roster is, you know, bands, and some of it is, you know, artists from those bands and their solo projects, which makes it kind of more easy to manage. So after I signed Fruition, Jenna Leibowitz, who is managing ALO at the time and still is now my management partner there, she kind of hit me and she's like, hey, you're managing? And I was like, you know, yeah, I just picked up Fruition. She's like, I've been looking for a co-manager forever. Would you be willing? So again, it was another kind of conversation of like, hey, you know, I work at your label. We have to have a very kind of upfront conversation about conflict of interest. Like, you have to be aware that I do label hat on, but I'd love to be involved with the band. They are, for me, like I've always had really like a passionate kind of love for great songwriters. And I also have, you know, that 60s into 70s thing kind of morphed into, you know, bands that were playing great live shows in the moment in the modern age. So bands like Fish and Widespread Panic, you know, there's a little bit of jam love in me, and ALO kind of straddles that line. So I said yes to that, and working for a label that's super artist friendly, it becomes very easy to not have a conflict of interest, because the interest is what's best for the artist, which, you know, you can't necessarily say for every label, but for us, it's kind of a mantra. And so Zach Gill, for instance, is, there's a lot of intertwining, really. You know, like Zach Gill is main singer and songwriter for ALO, but everybody in that band writes and sings. But he's also the keyboard player for Jack Johnson. When Jack is super busy, ALO by nature can't be. And Zach also can't be. You know, like his focus is on Jack in that window. And then in his downtime, you know, putting out ALO records or solo records and touring those. So that actually has a natural flow of like focus, right, which makes that kind of a little bit easier. Fruition, you know, Jay is one of the three songwriters from it. Mimi Naja is one of the others. I have helped Kellen, who's the third songwriter there, side project stuff, and actually even introduced him to Jimmy Jazz from G-Love and Special Sauce, who are former label alums. Like, and they now have a project together called Amp, because they both live in Portland. And TK and the Holy Know Nothings actually shares two members with Fruition. It's the songs of this amazing songwriter, Taylor Kingman. Drummer and the guitar player are from Fruition. There's a lot of overlap in kind of making sure that everybody's interests are serviced, and, you know, balancing people's schedules and stuff like that. So I guess my entire life is finding balance for other people.
Right. We have a clip of Strange Days, which is Animal Liberation Orchestra, or ALO, and that was in Smallville, I believe, right?
Yes, that was licensed in Smallville a number of years ago.
Milfreda, you want to play that clip?
Oh, I got a story. 35 million years old. Burns like the sun in my soul. And I hear a voice on the wind telling me it's gonna change. Holding my breath through these strange days.
And the next clip we have is also involves Zach Gill, called Family, and Milfreda's going to play that as well.
Generation to generation, it gets passed on. And then one day those who were passing, well, they passed on. Pulling back the covers
Wow, unbelievable. I mean, yeah. But you know what? It's like one after the other. I mean, we could literally just have an entire listening session with your archive.
So, Josh, obviously the landscape has changed, you know, with digital and everything now is online. You know, how do you compare the release of a new album today versus when you first started in the music business?
Things have changed quite a bit, but there is still that, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, it's still about, one, you kind of identifying the right song to lead with and get people to hear, whether that's playlists or radio or to get press to write about it. Just the method of consumption has changed such that, you know, we're less focused on, do we have enough physical product in Boise where KRVB is playing it? And more on, you know, are the right playlisting folks hearing this? You know, have we had a conversation to set up and explain this project? Are we doing a good job of telling the story of this record? Content we're rolling out, the interviews Jack's doing, everything. I almost feel like it's more telling a story now than it is selling a product. You used to have to think about selling physical goods, and you still do. You know, we're making a couple of colorways of the record for indie retail, you know, Target. And we're still making CDs. It's still a good chunk of
coming back,
the business. You know, before it felt more like a moment, and now it's a continuum. You know, like even before we got into this album cycle, you know, you just go in and look at Spotify for Artists, for instance. And, you know, now the last, you know, 28 days is probably influenced by the fact that there's new music. But, you know, he, in a normal month, has 9 million people listening to his music on Spotify worldwide.
Unbelievable.
And those people are streaming 60 million songs.
Unbelievable.
Like, you wouldn't see that kind of consumption in a trough period between records in the past. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, people would pick up like a classic record when they went to the record store, but the consumption would kind of like go, okay, we're in cycle, we're off cycle. And now there is no off cycle, really. You know, there's constantly things feeding what is the story of this artist and how are people discovering them, whether that's, you know, a TikTok or it's, you know, a film or TV license that comes off cycle. I mean, everybody's dream is to have, you know, okay, here's our album, here's our first single, and it's being used in this huge way. So that's going to help us launch the record. But we all know more often, like, you know, 2 years after the record comes out, somebody is like, hey, can we use that song?
Yeah.
And great, you know, it gives it another life. But if it had been timed to the beginning of the release, you know, it might have had a greater amplification. But it always works. And there's always a record in the stores now, which is the nice thing. You know, Jack's early career, he had so much buzz and so much interest, they couldn't keep records in the stores. And that's how, you know, he basically ended up forging the relationship with Republic, was that like the indie label was just making as many CDs as they could and shipping as many as they could. And it still wasn't enough. You know, people would just sell out. We'd be out of stock, sell out of stock. And it was brutal. Created like, you know, an arrangement with Republic to kind of help them get enough records out the door. And that was what cracked open the door to a longer term relationship and everything. But now it's like, you know, every piece of music that has the proper licensing, you can find. Yes, there are like key moments of musical history that aren't there. And that's obviously another conversation about, you know, when you think everything is out there, it really isn't. There's plenty of great records that for whatever reason on licensing aren't available on Spotify. And if they're not in print and they're not on Spotify or Apple Music, like, do they exist? You know, they should, but in the current model, they sort of don't. So that, it's an interesting blind spot right now, but the music business is totally different, but it's still sort of very much the same. We're still talking to the radio stations we were 15 years ago. There might be somebody that was a production intern back then that's now the musical director, but they're still there. You know, there are fewer magazines, of course, to write about it. There are fewer places to carry physical goods, but there's an infinite supply of streams that you can never exhaust. So if you find somebody new, they can dive into your entire catalog. You know, I had to buy it, you know, one record at a time for $16.99.
Yeah.
Now it's like, you know, for $9.99, you can listen to every piece of music Jack's ever released. And from the looks of it and the looks of the data, people do, you know, they find him and they go like, whoa, and they can go back and just listen to all the great stuff he's written and recorded over.
I know as a music supervisor, you're going to be my first call every time I'm on a film now moving forward. And I've been telling Rose, you know, because we did have a chance to talk before the show tonight, you know, was like, oh, I would never, ever even consider passing something for Jack Johnson. This archive that we're playing tonight, just like the tip of the iceberg. I just didn't even think that, you know, this stuff would be considered. Knowing where your entire team comes from, you know, community that you guys have built where you're working together, it's the fans first. It's just amazing, Josh, what you have been a part of building. And God, man, I'm a huge fan of yours, man. I just think what you're doing is, we need more label executives and managers like you. You're just amazing.
Thanks, man. It's a huge compliment. And really, it does speak to like the stuff I've been lucky enough to work on. And group of great musicians that we work with, you know, all of whom I consider friends. Even the folks that, you know, may have had a 3-album deal and are now elsewhere, you know, when I see them, it's still, you know, running into friends. I just saw G-Love in Philadelphia at Noncom radio convention, and he's put out 2 records since we worked together, but we're still super tight.
And Money Mark, I mean, there's so many people that we're not going to even get a chance to touch on tonight that I might just have to call you and have a conversation on my own. I know I've cut Colin off. He has one last bit of his question before we wind up, but I had to interject. You know, what you're doing, Josh, it's incredible. And I am just blown away with who you are.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And I look forward to talking to you about our entire catalog.
Thank you, Josh.
On June 24th, Jack Johnson released Meet the Moonlight, his first full-length album in 5 years, right before his summer tour started. Can you tell us what inspired the collective of songs that ended up on the album?
Yeah, sure. Jack is definitely somebody that's, I think, constantly writing, but volume. So when we put out a Jack record and there's 10 songs on it, very often he's only written 10, 11, 12, maybe 13 songs. So, you know, there are certain songwriters that, you know, will get in there and write a song a day no matter what, and then kind of pick through the best of the bunch. He kind of, his process is to really let life happen and observe things going on in his backyard, in the world, in his family, with his friends, and kind of let those things filter through. And eventually there's kind of a synthesis of, you know, a riff and a lyric, and he starts kind of writing, you know, songs and artists. So our album cycles tend to be like, when does he have 10 to 12 songs that he's really excited about recording? And then, you know, figuring out how we're going to record them and where. Up until pre-pandemic, we had a recording studio in the back of our office on Larchmont in LA. We ended up selling that in part because Jack's real preference is to record near home, near family on Hawaii. This record, funnily enough, given we had sold our studio, started in LA, which is a spot that it doesn't feel 100% comfortable with. And doesn't necessarily love, can find spots that feel great. And so we were talking about how to make a new record feel, you know, this many years and records in, feel fresh, but not feel, you know, he's got a very consistent, I think, sound and songwriting process. So people really kind of have, if you love one record, you very often can find a bunch of songs on any other record that you would love. But our feeling was that, you know, it would be fun to kind of work with somebody that he hadn't worked with before, you know, find something to give him a new challenge. You know, he's a great songwriter and, you know, he kind of has a really great sense of how he wants his voice to sound, how he wants his guitar to sound. But we kind of looked at like, you know, Blake as a great option because, you know, we think back to, I think that really the thing that we looked at was Alabama Shake's first record and their second record. So that first record that was an amazing record and had a very distinct, you know, kind of Alabama Muscle Shoals kind of sound. And when they announced the second record, I think the easy answer would have been like, okay, here comes another one. Like they nailed that. They've definitely got another one of those. And then when you put sound and color on, it sounded nothing like the first record, but at the same time sounded exactly like the Alabama Shakes. And I think that that's what Jack and Blake kind of found together. The record's very much the two of them playing almost everything on the record, whether that's guitar, bass, drums. At the very end, the band did come in and cut a song called Don't Look Now. And they did kind of put a few touches on a few other songs. But the great bulk of the record is the two of them kind of finding each other musically in the studio. And the first thing they did was this song, One Step Ahead, and they sent the demo back. And everybody at the label, you know, Kizzy, Emmett, myself, were just like, wow, like this feels totally like Jack, but feels also totally different. And I think that's kind of what they found with this record. The people that have heard it, you know, now the world will have when we're having this conversation out in the world. But people that heard it early, I think universally the note has been like, wow, like I haven't heard any of these sounds on a Jack record before, but it still feels exactly like a Jack record. And so they kind of nailed what we were hoping, which is all these things that take your ears in different places, but still give you that, like, that feeling of a Jack record, which very oftentimes people are looking for a feeling of, you know, peace, you know, they're looking for a feeling of, you know, like I said, from the way back, you know, like what is like a coastal life feel like and sound like, you know, what are those records that feel like there's a palm tree swaying in the background while it was being made? Maybe there's some of the birds that were outside of the studio. You can hear them at the top of the track, you know, like the record feels, I think, like very much like what the world wants from a Jack record and honestly probably needs. You know, it's been a rough few years. And I think lyrically, some of the themes that he writes about speak to that feeling of being unsettled from, you know, the world shutting down, from shifting rules, and certainly political arguments and everything. And we think it's a beautiful record with the right message landing at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Which really, we haven't even talked about the work he does in charity, which is a crime for you know. But we didn't want to make this all about Jack. We wanted to make this about Josh. So I think it's kind of it's okay that we've missed that, but maybe just before Colin closes, can you tell us about some of the charity work that Jack and his wife are championing, and you know, how, you know, money from his gigs are going to this? I mean, I think there was even a complete tour where Jack didn't get paid at all. It all went to charity. I think there's, you know, from the shows I've been to, I always see these booths of these amazing charities camped out front, you know, passing out information, you know, all being done before, you know, Greta and the whole real climate change movement mm-hmm. kicked in. And I just find that just so compelling. If we could spend just a minute hearing about that.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, part of, like I was talking about earlier, like working on music I love is, it's been important, like working with people I like and respect. And, you know, that's kind of impossible not to have for Jack. You know, Jack and Kim have two kind of main charitable foundations. One's the Kukua Hawaii Foundation, which is focused on Hawaii, and the other is the Johnson Ohana Charitable Foundation, focused outside of Hawaii. Their biggest kind of push is always around environmental causes. And the secondary one is musical education for kids. In 2008 and 2010, took all of profits from those tours and put them into Kukua and the JOCF.
Has that ever been done before by any other artist, Josh? Have you ever heard anybody do
it? Yeah.
No, never.
I don't think so. I mean, like I said earlier, he had one of the great early record deals. So those records that were hugely successful were also, you know, hugely profitable. And I think, you know, he's somebody who's very comfortable living, if he had to, in very modest circumstances. If he can be near a body of water and surf and is near his family, that's about all he really needs. Obviously, he's been successful enough to have more than that. But because they, you know, were in a good financial situation already, you know, their feeling is that, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done for future generations with the environment. They have kids. Their, you know, siblings have kids. They're very focused on the environmental future of the planet. So at every show, you know, we'll have anywhere from 5 to 10 local nonprofits. All of them will get an initial grant and then be able to come back and write grant proposals for ongoing projects. So once somebody's kind of like worked with the tour locally, then there's kind of an ongoing conversation of like, okay, what are you guys working on? What do you need money for? And so they've done, yeah, I mean, the amount of money that those two tours generated for those charities and the amount of money that's been donated back out continues to kind of come in. You know, the current tour is not 100% to charity because those two tours in 2008 and 2010 were massive tours and generated a lot. So now a percentage of what's generated goes there. And we always kind of do things like we'll pull like 50 best tickets and do, 100% of those go there. The business has shifted where platinum and premium tickets have become a thing to, part to make sure that scalpers aren't, the ones who make the most off of the best seats, but also, we're taking any of the lift from those tickets. So anything that's not face value is then going towards the charitable side of things. They just continue to, really amaze me about how much focus they put on the charitable side. Honestly, it's at an equal level to the business side for them. They think about in everything they do, what is the environmental impact? What can we do to offset it? And if we are going to do something like touring, which is inherently, has some negative environmental impact, how can we offset that? And how can we make it, rather than just offset, how can we do even greater good by being out there?
You know what? I hate this. It just gets under my skin. Here, there's somebody that's leading a warrior campaign for good. And I'm sure that like media, the press, they don't probably just don't care because we don't hear these details. When you read about, Jack's new album or the tour, I'm sure this is something they just overlook. And it's just such an important thing. So thank you for sharing that with our audience. And I really hope that things change where this becomes as important as the art, because, single-handedly, this guy's out there changing the world, and it's just amazing.
100%, yeah. Great human beings and, an amazing artist. It's, again, one of the reasons I consider myself lucky to be in the business and in the segment of the business that I am.
Lucky management. What do you think, Colin? Should we hear a new Jack Johnson song?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to do. I was going to say, let's listen to Jack Johnson's first single release from his latest album, Meet the Moonlight, One Step Ahead. Play it, Manfredo.
If each choir is preaching and everyone's reaching into their pockets to see what they got, if not, a lot has changed. But if everything's changing, play to see you say, but no one sees face to face or eye to eye. This is not how it has to end.
Legend.
This just personally is probably my favorite record since 2008, Sleep Through the Static. And he's made really good records since then. So top to bottom, just beautiful record. I couldn't be happier about the alchemy that was kind of created between Blake and Jack on this record, the songs that are on it. I think people are really going to fall in love with this one.
I've already fallen in love with it.
Oh, it sounds amazing. Well, listen, Josh, it was wonderful having you on the show tonight. Thank you so much to Josh Nicotra for joining us.
Great speaking with all of you too. Thanks very much.
Hey guys.
Hey Jace.
Hey Jason. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Just buried in paperwork.
Oh, for the sync report.
Not this time. Move me no mountain.
That indie film your music supervising?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great project. What's the problem?
It's a brilliant film and we're building a great soundtrack, but you can't imagine how much paperwork I deal with for these films.
Have you heard of Sync Lodge?
First, you got to draft up the sync request forms.
I've heard of Sync Lodge.
Then drafting and issuing contracts.
Yep, Sync Lodge is great, Paula. It does everything a music supervisor needs.
Then deliver the cue sheet. It never ends.
Doesn't Sync Lodge do all of that automatically?
Sweat Lodge? What are you guys banging on about? I got real issues I'm sharing with you guys.
Yeah, lots of issues.
We're trying to tell you, Jason. Sync Lodge is a new platform for music supervisors. It helps you to source the music, sync songs against scenes, draft up sync requests, and even creates the cue sheets once you've locked in the music to the film.
Whoa, Sync Lodge does all that?
It's true, Jason. I just started using it for the sync report, and it's not only saving time, but it's so easy to use, I'm actually enjoying the work.
You guys are the best. Sync Lodge sounds amazing and exactly what I need for music supervising. Why am I always the last one to hear about these things?
I've been telling you about Sync Lodge for weeks.
Don't feel bad, Edge, for not telling me sooner. I know you're busy. You're a good guy.
Paula, is my mic on? Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Edge.
Guys, what's the name of that program again?
Sync Lodge.
That is something to scream about. Yes, you too can be cool like Edge and use cutting edge technology to help you with your film and TV productions. No matter if you're a music supervisor, director, producer, editor, save time and increase proficiency with Sync Lodge.
I need to find a new thing.
So, hello, everyone. Welcome to the Sync Report. This is going to be an amazing night. I'm so excited. We have the final listening session for Kevin Sharpley's film. We have some fun, exciting announcements. And we're announcing our upcoming new brief, which is for the Sync Report TV Christmas special. Oh my God, I let that huge cat out of the bag. Kevin will be telling you all about that shortly. And I see actually two of our newest cast members, the Young Wizard and Dan Thomas, who's actually going to be telling us every week what is hot and what is not in Web3, Metaverse, what's happening with NFTs. These two are going to be the official beta testers for everything that is Zavatar and everything that exists within the Zataverse. Yeah, Dan, do you want to say hello? Give everybody a little background on yourself, and then maybe Young Wizard can, and you guys can tell us what the topic is for tonight.
Cool. Well, Sam, Dan Thomas. So I'm a solution architect and copywriter working in Web3, and I've been working actively in it for last 3 years, give or take. I've been involved in the space since about 2013. Basically, I help companies build the tech stack, and then I help them convince people they should be using it.
I mean, 2013, who was even, besides Kevin Sharpley, even thinking about this stuff? Totally insane. These guys can give such incredible advice and guidance for you, our songwriters, if you're looking to get into that NFT world. So, Young Wizard, say hello.
Hello. I'm just kidding. How's everybody doing?
How's Vegas?
It is hot, and I'm trying to enjoy the weekend, you know, the holiday weekend with my family. And then because, you know, the nature of this industry, it's nonstop 24/7 and global, especially when you're of caliber, right? So the man you're seeing right now, that was an older me in a past life. I actually go around LinkedIn currently as a wizard, 8-bit wizard avatar that these guys were so kind as to look to, you know, start building out. And it's funny that Dan showed up with his avatar, right, Jason? Because he actually was the measuring stick for me coming in, looking around the space of who was doing quality and was tenured, and then also had an avatar or even a, you know, NFT associated with it. And he was already a step ahead.
Well, he actually made a film, didn't he, about all with avatars. I mean, Craig was telling us about it last week.
Oh, man.
So what is, Young Wizard, what is the topic tonight?
I'm going to put it out there, and then Dan's going to run point on it. We're going to talk about marketing in the space.
So important. I was just going to say, Young Wizard, this is such an important topic. It's almost like how PR is for, you know, the music community. You can go and spend some crazy money on PR and then never get anything, you know, and this is something that I've had, you know, I've dealt with over and over again, developing talent. I know a lot of friends of mine who are artists, you know, have spent a lot of money on PR and been very frustrated with the results. Look, the same thing is with marketing. You know, if you're not with the right, you know, people, if you're not getting the right advice, you can go and spend crazy money and not see any results. So if you are a songwriter, if you're thinking about moving into the NFT world with your music, because it's something you should be considering, this is going to be a really great moment. Our community probably doesn't have like huge corporate dollars to spend on marketing. So what are some cheats? How can these guys get into that community without spending an arm and a leg?
So, I mean, the thing with Web3 is we all go on about community in Web3. And it's something actually that struck me when I joined last week, that all these Web3 communities are going, we need to be building a community and doing all this stuff. And they're all doing the same thing, whereas you guys actually have a proper community. So when you move into that Web3 space, you'll find it kind of fits quite well because you've already got, you know, your fellow artists, your people you're talking to, the people you're engaging with. And that's where the strength of Web3 is. It's not in the centralized massive marketing agency, as much as Gary Vaynerchuk wants it to be. It's not about that. It's about the smaller individual choices and the individuals making those decisions themselves of who they want to be heard by, who they want to get in front of, and how they want to engage them. And it's quite a good time to get into it now, if you're thinking about it, because you may not be aware if you don't follow it, but everything's kind of crashed. Like, everything has gone south. Like, really badly. Yeah.
And to that point, right, to strengthen that argument about if there was ever a time to want to jump in head first and get your feet dirty, and it's now, because all of the standards that were before, as far as regarding the community building, people come and want to quickly ingest and qualify what is good and what isn't good of the project or a company. And the standard currently has been set that Twitter and Discord is where NFTs have to happen, right? That's where all the demographics are and the buyers and everything's just got it. I would rebuttal to that absolutely. You need to meet your community that, or your target audience where they use social media, or identify where they're going to be, and then, or a better place for them to be, and create it there organically and offboard them to that place.
And so, young wizard Dan, if I was able to get $100 a month together to promote my NFT, what do I need? Is there a visual? Does it have to be animated? And where would I be best served?
I think what we're going to see now is actually a bit of a flip in it. So what we've had for the past, you know, I mean, I got the first NFT a couple of years ago now. And for that, it was always about, it's an NFT, you're buying an NFT. And what we're seeing now is that sort of excitement with the technology is moving away. And we're going to see people say, actually, it's not just an NFT, it's a piece of artwork, it's a membership to a community, it's access to something.
And it's such an interesting time, too, because I recently created our wallet, our digital wallet for the Sync Report, to do our NFTs. And I'm watching it actually grow. You know, I'm actually making money by having money in my wallet at the moment, which is kind of exciting. Okay, excellent. How much fun are we having? Paula, what is the next audio gold we're playing for our audience?
We are playing Tim Qual's Fear and Loathing in Houston.
Oh, I love Tim. Tim, say hello. Tell us again. I mean, you've been on our stage a few times. I love the stuff that you've been bringing into the room. Give us a little introduction. Tell us more so, like, what was the inspiration behind that track? Again, another gorgeous score sound.
Yeah, I've just been doing a little scoring on my own. And that was just one of the things that I came up with in the time. And, I got another hit for that brief in my email, and I thought, well, let me pull up that brief again. And I kind of edited it to what I thought could potentially fit. Obviously, I don't know the specifics like Kevin would know, but, I just thought it was pretty cinematic and,
very
edgy, but, seductive, all those little things. So I don't know. I just thought it was a cool track, and why not submit it? I'm an artist, so typically my music is my music that I'm submitting, but I've had a lot of fun kind of creating specifically for film and stuff like that. So I'm pretty cool.
Well, I can see why you're having success, Tim. It's why I love you, part of this community. Phil, what'd you think of that track?
I was really interested to hear. It sounded like there was a sort of a consistent noise going throughout the track, a sort of sound design, which I kind of liked underneath what felt like a vocal layer. I'm not sure if that was in there, Tim, something like a vocal layer or something, but something turning around, some vocal voice, which I thought set the track out really nicely. It seemed to sit really comfortably in a scene, and a few sort of abstract sounds in the distance worked really well. So I liked it, Tim. It definitely sort of dropped me into a film sort of maybe a bit, horror genre sort of feel to it. Definitely.
Yeah.
I liked all the little incidental parts on top as well. It just took me place, little bits of ear candy.
Paula, unmute and tell us who's next.
I'm on Zoom.
Oh, are you here?
Yeah, here I am.
Why do you look like a chicken nugget?
Oh, you're so hilarious.
That's for Willow. I love you, Willow. All right, give it to me, lady.
You're throwing me now. Oh, yes, right. So the next song is Alibi by Solar the Legends.
Baby, well, I'm so sweet. Didn't want to know the truth. Living in a fantasy, cause it's what I want to do. I bleed. I've been sitting by the phone and waiting for my love to call. I've been lying in a bed and crying. You left me here. The truth, running from reality, cause it's what you like to do. Enemy to set you free, said you couldn't run a time. Now you're crawling back to me, but baby, my tears gonna testify. Get you get from me, you sorry shit. Cause what you gave is what you get. You got it late, but get it quick. Now I'm not that dopey chicken dove who used to cry and play your please. I'm sure not your alibi. Your alibi.
I love it. 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 Jody, what is going on? How come I have not heard that song before?
First of all, Mishka, who is in our audience, it was a co-write me and him did when we first joined the Catch the Moon group. He's massively did all the music.
Wow.
So I'm only going to say one thing, and I hope I get my joke okay. I figured that if the movie's called Deadly Night Out, that somebody's going to need an alibi.
Oh, I love it. And honestly, Jody, that song, I'm going to add that to my own personal playlist. In fact, Heather, please tag that with a Sync Report star, because that is going in my bag for the Sync Report. That was brilliant. That was so good. Who was singing?
Sula the Legend. But could I have Mishka talk about it? Because I feel he did all the mastery on it.
Mishka, where's Mishka? Are you playing piano on that?
I did the MIDI of the piano, but then I sent it to a couple of different people to play. So it's a bit of a mishmash of different people, really. But yeah, it came together. We got Jody wrote the lyrics to get started, and then Sula came on board and changed a few of the lyrics.
Mishka, fantastic. I really, yeah, cool. Honestly, I love the track. But let's let the pros weigh in. Vinks, what did you think of the track? Hi, Vinks. Tell me, was that song awesome?
Oh, come on, baby. Come on, baby. it had a great vibe, and the groove was good. But then that good Louie Weedy, and so they could easily choose the age of the woman of the film's fatales. It was very easy to sing in the generation of the woman that it represents. So I thought it was set up beautifully, and yeah, I dug it. You know, for me, you know, the jazz and the. It left space for your imagination.
I'm so with you. I mean, Jody has brought some great music to this room, but I think that is like pole position for that woman. Okay, Paula, do you know? You probably don't even know. I think we need Heather to tell us who the final submission. Do you know?
I know. We have an audience submission by someone you might know, actually. It's called Use Me by an artist called Nome.
Oh, do I know Nome? Oh, I'm in love with this Nome, her and her family. What incredible people. Oh, let's hear my favorite music supervisor, Jess Rodriguez. What does she have to contribute?
Lose your mind. Feel it come to life. Open your eyes, even shut so tight, so I can feel the trembling underneath my skin. Waiting, wanting to give in.
Oh,
Like a sucker punch right to the bread box. Was I expecting that? Not at all. This woman continues to blow my mind. I hate her because she's no longer part of the Syncroport, but I love her because she's a freaking genius. My God, Jess, welcome to the stage. Welcome back, my gorgeous. What was that? Where did that come from? Please unmute and introduce yourself, because you haven't been on stage for a while, and give us a little background where that came from. So different.
Hi, I'm so happy to hear your voice, Jason.
I've missed you, woman.
I have been MIA. For first introduction, singer-songwriter, working for different briefs in sync occasionally. So this was a collaboration with me and Ana Saucedo. We work together a lot. We're kind of, you know, Zoom besties. And this was for a specific, like, brief, I guess, to say, or actually we had a specific show in mind, but we weren't going to pitch it to that show. It was just like a creative challenge that we were giving ourselves. I kind of struggled with the writing, but then she's really good about rhythm and just the sounds she was using. And so, yeah, it all came together and I was really happy with.
Yeah, that was, wow. All right, Kev, why don't you go ahead, unleash that mic and tell Jess how horrible she was. I'm sure you hated that track.
The song, I loved it. I talked about variants. This song, so this one kind of, you know, points more directly at the young lady that is being coerced. And one thing I didn't say is eventually at the end of the scene, she capitulates. And so this song is directly connected with that. And, you know, in terms of pacing this scene, this is the song that I'm going to use if I need to speak to her. If this the scene is cut towards her voice and towards, you know, moving in that direction where she is, you know, really, really feeling that pressure, because it also has a lot of other layers. It has a youthful feel. I spoke about the musicians that are doing the bigger score. And so what really worked in terms of connecting with them is they do, you know, this kind of mix of dream pop and, you know, this earthial sound. I mentioned David Lynch, but, you know, that is a mix of, you know, that and David Lynch and all these kind of sinister things. But this song has, you know, this kind of, you know, dream pop electronic feel to it at the same time, all at once. And so I always love having layers. It then allows you to say a lot within one given moment. And this song does that. Great job. This one is another one to help bulge that that A-list. So. Nice one, Jess. Thanks.
Thank you so much to our amazingly talented guests for joining us on today's show, and to you, our listeners, for spending your time listening to us and being with us. The Syncroport cast will be back in a week with your hosts, myself, Colin O'Donoghue, Rose Ganguza, and Jason P. Rothberg. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.
Today's episode was produced by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Paula Flack, and Robert Capadonna. It was written by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Lisa Dunn, and Paula Flack. Editing was by Jason P. Rothberg, Milfredo Seven, Paula Flack, Edgar Edge Kamei, and Adam McNamara. Research by Lisa Dunn. Graphic design by Jody Lynn Talevi. Brought to you by Zavatar.